Thanks. We have a set of consolidated appeals here. The basis that some of the defendants had joined in Mr. Whitehead's briefing thought it made sense to let counsel for Whitehead go first. So, Mr. Goldberger, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Are you reserving time for rebuttal?
I've noted 2 minutes with the clerk, if that's all right.
2 minutes, that's fine.
And I very much appreciate the court accommodating my personal schedule 2 months ago and rescheduling this argument. It's very, very kind of you.
All right. Thanks.
May it please the court, my name is Peter Goldberger, and it's my privilege this afternoon to represent Ronnell Whitehead, one of the appellants. He was convicted after trial on a drug conspiracy count and sentenced for that and three substantive counts to which he had pleaded guilty on the eve of the opening of the trial.
Right.
So four counts underlie the sentence. We have two issues briefed on the conduct of the trial, one fundamental error issue in addition to that in the jury instructions that relate to the quantity attribution for sentencing purposes, and finally a challenge to the career offender classification. All the issues relate one way or another to the conspiracy issue. That is the theme of the trial.
Yeah.
That is how the government stretched the notion of conspiracy to reach this collection of small-time drug dealers who in some respects competed with each other and in other respects cooperated.
When you say they stretched it, they had the leader of the conspiracy testify against all the others. That was pretty good move by the government, I guess.
Not my idea of how to arrange the cooperation, but I'm not a prosecutor. So.
Doesn't usually work that way, where you flip the top against
one,
all the smaller ones, but that's how it worked here.
Yeah.
A great deal of your briefing centers on your contention that Agent Updegraff, if I'm saying the gentleman's name right.
I think that's right.
Was crossed the line of 704.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd appreciate if you would get right to that.
Okay. Well, that's, I think, a good place to start in any event, and I'm certainly well on invitation. So Agent Updegraff is the case agent, and he's used by the government as their expert. Now, they can do that if they want to, but it does create the practical problems that this court's cases talk about when that refer to agents testifying as experts.
At the end of the day, Mr. Goldberg, is it your contention that the references to group, that Agent Updegraff referred
right.
to this collection or
mm-hmm.
as a group, that crossed the line? That's my reading of your position.
Yes. The way that term was used was a euphemism for the intent to agree element of a conspiracy charge.
Well, what collective noun wouldn't have been, in your view? What synonym besides group would you have been comfortable with?
I don't think they had any need to use a synonym or a euphemism at all. This was the jury question in the case. So the agent is inherently testifying one way or another, whatever word they choose to avoid using the word conspiracy.
So how would we write an opinion that says, in effect, you can never use a collective noun when you're speaking about the members of an alleged conspiracy, because that in itself will say that there is a conspiracy, and that's a violation of Rule 704, which seems to be the argument you're making.
If you are a fact witness, say a cooperator, that's one thing. But to express an opinion as an expert that puts the label on, that's where the problem arises if it ventures into intent.
But does group necessarily imply they had the mens rea to conspire to sell drugs as a collective?
It implies the intent to agree on a common objective. It doesn't have to be drugs, but in this instance, that is what it means. Yeah. Yes.
Well, you've the government in a footnote says, This was indisputably a group, but that
right.
essentially articulating, I think, in different words,
exactly what they said.
Judge Restrepo was just noted. What is it about the word group in this context that makes you say, I mean, if I speak about a group of Third Circuit judges, that certainly doesn't imply that they have a common agreement. Some of them do, actually.
I don't know about that. It implies.
Why does it carry with it, you think, the mens rea of common intent?
It's what makes an aggregation of individuals into a group is some common purpose. The group of judges may be meeting for lunch, or they may be meeting to discuss cases, or they may be having a party, but
it doesn't mean that they intend a particular thing when they get together necessarily. I mean, it's true we might have maybe I should take it out of the court lest we be accused of some conspiracy, but you can have groups get together for any number of reasons,
yes.
And it doesn't tell you they share a common objective or a common mindset or a common, like, you can have a group of people on a train. I guess you could say they're all conspiring,
yes,
to go to a destination where that train might stop, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to the same place. Why is it that a group carries with it necessarily the implication of a common intent?
Right. So I wouldn't say it necessarily implies a conspiracy, because that implies that the objective is criminal. But the group implies a common objective of some sort. Otherwise, this aggregation of individuals, people who live in the same city, in the same neighborhood, are not a group, unless someone is defining or seeking a decision maker like a jury define a common objective that they have. And the one the government is arguing, of course, in this is the criminal objective.
The testimony that people acted together necessarily always mean, that it's testimony that they agreed to act together.
Well, first of all, I'm not talking about any fact witnesses. So an opinion, right, that they acted together, I think, does imply some level of intent to do so.
If the agent
says, of course, the jury might disagree. I'm sorry. Yeah. The lawyer might argue that to draw a different inference,
yeah,
from the same facts. But the government is making the concluteness, having their expert draw the conclusion for the jury that there is a commonality of purpose.
Sorry. If the expert had said, I've been at this for 30 years, and in my experience, when these actors work together at a conspiracy, this is what it looks like. I have no idea what these guys intended subjectively, but it looked like that, what I just described. Would that be okay?
I would not want to see the word conspiracy used, because to draw the ultimate conclusion that it is a particular crime. But assuming other word, I think that touches on the other problem with the fact that it was the case agent. So what this court's cases say is that the case agent...
Let's stay away from that for a minute. Just wrestle with one at a time.
Okay? All right.
Is there something further that you want to say in response to what Judge?
I think I'm having trouble imagining a situation in which an expert a witness who is held out as an expert, mm-hmm, could express an opinion that this collection of persons was acting as a group, not just mentioning it, but making the point that they're acting as a group. That's the point of the testimony, without implying something about their intent. And in this case, the thing about their intent is the very thing about intent, which is an element of the crime of conspiracy.
In my hypothetical question, what if the witness said, I'm telling you, I don't know what was in their minds. All I know is this is what it looked like, and that's consistent with group activity based on my 30 years of experience.
The right way to ask the question is for the lawyer to ask hypothetically, if it were this fact, and that fact, would it be consistent? So as soon as the agent, and this is the case agent problem, if I may, says, these are the facts of this case, and I draw this inference, that's over the line of the case law. That's already over the line of the case law, because it's not responding to a question that's framed like a question to an expert.
Imagine an antitrust conspiracy, a criminal prosecution for antitrust conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And the expert who's brought in to explain this recondite area to a jury, says you have a group of widget producers, and it can, this group did the following things. This could be a concerted action. There is such a thing as parallel action in a conspiracy like this. Here are things that a group like this might do that would lead you to conclude, or could lead you to conclude, that it was not just parallel action. You've identified a group. You've talked about what might be happening at the same time. And you've told the jury that there are markers for concerted action as opposed to coincidental independent action. Is the fact that you've identified the group as a group something that takes that over the line?
That troubles me, and is the first thing that makes me ask, has it gone over the line, rather than saying, you have a number of widget producers, and they do this, and they do that, and they do it at the same time, and that is consistent. It is,
in the literal sense, a group. It's an industry group. It's a bunch of industry actors. In my hypothetical, they're all, you know, in this business of widgeting. But it's the word group that's really carries it, to you. It is freighted with the meaning of common mens rea.
Particularly in a case where the very question for the jury was, is this an aggregation of competing individuals, or is this a group that is engaged in concerted action?
Let me go back to a question Judge Jordan asked. What noun would be, if any, would be appropriate in the 704 context?
I suggested a number of individuals, which leaves the jury to draw the conclusion, or the group is properly treated as being a conclusion and not a description. The word is fine if it's asked about and presented as a conclusion, and it doesn't it's presented in a way that doesn't violate Rule 704.
Let me take a step back and ask about the standard of review on this point. If I read your briefing right, you think that the burden is on the government here to prove any problem is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Maybe I missed. What's the standard?
I don't think I said it was a constitutional error, so I don't think I would have said beyond a reasonable doubt. But
what's our standard of review?
Harmless error. With the burden on the government to show that. You can say with confidence that the jury verdict was unaffected by the error, because there was an objection that was close enough to what I'm saying to count as an objection to this point.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've confused this with the shooting.
That may be. Yeah.
With that standard of review in mind. When Judge McHugh ruled on it and said it was coming in, was there any later objection about any other thing that was said, or was it an objection as to group and then nothing further?
I'm not confusing it in the same way that you just hinted we might, as I sometimes might, between argument and the first and second points. I believe it was preserved and not raised again. I don't think they later said, Judge, that crosses the line, I want to renew that objection. I don't think so.
Okay. And when it was raised, it was
my colleagues may correct me on that.
Yeah, it was raised in the context of calling them a group.
I believe so, yes. Okay. But it was pointing on their intent. If I could move on to,
please.
Maybe in the interest of time, I will rest on my brief with respect to the 402 and 403 argument, unless you had questions.
The shooting,
in particular, the shooting elements.
Yeah. Well, let me do ask about that. Because,
sure.
The relevance objection that came after the discussion about Mr. Whitehead being shot in the park, right? I guess I'm trying to think, if I read the record right, there was no objection when that was being talked about. The objection came up later with respect to
Dorsey saying,
the argument that this beef had nothing to do with the drug conspiracy. Am I wrong or am I right about that?
No, the beef had nothing to do argument was about the shooting at Whitehead. The government definitely, their argument was that Dorsey's shooting at outsiders definitely had to do, was his way of protecting the territory from competitors or police.
Keeping the police out of there so they could continue making money.
Yeah, so that we conceded that the government had an argument that made it relevant. So that's why this was strictly a 403 argument on the shooting by Dorsey as presented in our brief. But our argument about the shooting at Whitehead, we separate out as being literally irrelevant and highly prejudicial.
But we'll go I'll go back and take a look at it. But would you agree if the argument that was raised is you can't prove this beef was over drugs was actually made with respect to Mr. Dorsey being shot in the leg?
Mr. Whitehead was shot in the leg.
I'm sorry, Mr. Whitehead was shot in the leg.
Yeah.
I mean, if that's not the juncture where it's made, I mean, you can't make an objection after the fact and have it reach back and get your earlier stuff, can you?
Well, no.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, didn't the defense use the shootings fairly aggressively in the cross-examination of cooperating witnesses?
Once the judge ruled that he wasn't going to exclude it, the defense did what they were entitled to do, which is to try to make the best of it. You don't waive your objection once the judge overrules it by using that evidence as best you can.
Who put that in play first, the government or the defense?
The government.
The government introduced the shootings.
I mean, each shooting was, the video was played three times, three different witnesses testified about it. It was emphasized. It was in the government's opening and closing arguments. This was not treated as peripheral to the case. The government wanted the emotional impact of this evidence to bolster, even though it had very little to do with what we started out talking about, was this a group or were these individuals? Dorsey had an interest in keeping folks out of the neighborhood to protect himself and his business of selling to smaller sellers, whether those smaller sellers were in an agreement, you know, in a conspiracy with each other or not. Which is why that was relevant.
Okay.
So if I could...
Will you talk about, please, the argument that delivery and
yes,
distribution are somehow different, one broader than the other?
Right. So I'm skipping over the third argument here, which was about the framing of the quantity attribution in the jury instructions, which... We argued did not follow the subsequent authoritative decision in this court. And I will turn to the career offender issue, which you're asking about, of course.
Thanks.
Yes. So to be a career offender, you have to have a triggering federal conviction, which in this instance was thought to be, I have to be clear about this, was thought to be Whitehead's present conviction for conspiracy, but... After Nassar, actually, you have to view it as being those distributions that he pleaded to, the triggering instant offenses, because conspiracy doesn't count under Nassar. But in any event, that you still the question you're asking about is a question about the priors. So you have to have, in this instance, two qualifying controlled substances offenses, as defined, not in Title 21 or not anywhere else, but as defined in the Sentencing Guidelines Manual. The Sentencing Guidelines Manual says that a prior drug conviction counts as a prior controlled substances offense if it is for distribution or dispensing, as is relevant here. But there are, in fact, three kinds of delivery under federal or state drug law: distribution, dispensing, and administering. So the Sentencing Commission has excluded administering from the definition of qualifying prior offenses. The So that's the premise of the argument. And then when you look at the papers that describe the prior offenses in Pennsylvania that my client had, and is true of a number of other people who have prior Pennsylvania offenses, you see a conviction for delivering without explanation, without elaboration, without explication of whether it is delivering in the category of distributing or in the category of the dispensing or in the category of administering.
Yeah.
So and that is how the Pennsylvania offense is categorically broader than the definition in the federal guideline, and thus cannot be used unless the file of the defendant's case shows that it was not administering.
Have we ever said before, look, these are not a match, this is a categorical mismatch?
Not on this argument, I don't believe. You have said in dictum that there is no categorical mismatch between Pennsylvania and federals, between the Pennsylvania statute and the guidelines in the Glass case. But to the extent that language covers what I'm saying, it's purely dictum.
Mm-hmm. And your position is that, in any event, Glass was overruled by Nasir?
I think I overstated that in my reply brief. I think Glass rests on like three different arguments, one of which is overruled by Nasir. So whether Glass would stand stood the Nasir violative leg of the stool that it rests on, I can't say. And happily, for present purposes, I don't have to win and don't have to argue.
Okay.
One headache per case, if possible.
Questions? All right.
Shall we leave it there?
We'll have you on the bus.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Julie McGrain, Assistant Federal Public Defender, on behalf of Defendant Donald Womack. I would respectfully request 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you. I joined Mr. Goldberger in points one and two of his brief, so the 704 argument and the jury instruction argument, and I will defer to him on the expert argument that he gave today. I think there's a little bit of overlap between the jury instruction argument and the firearm enhancement argument that I'm making. Both of them stem from the idea of what is reasonably foreseeable to someone within the scope of their agreement when it comes to a conspiracy. And in Williams, this court, for purposes of the jury instruction, made very clear that we have to be more stringent than is something simply reasonably foreseeable to the conspiracy as a whole, and we have to look at the individual defendant's participation and the scope of their agreement.
And your position is that Mr. Womack couldn't have expected or known that guns were going to be used in connection with this conspiracy?
No, it's clear that it was reasonably foreseeable to Mr. Womack that guns were going to be used as part of this conspiracy. He talked with his nephew, Dorsey, about that in a recorded conversation that someone testified about at the trial. What the judge did, though, was conflate the idea of reasonable foreseeability and this sort of clearly improbable language that guns and drugs are always connected, and made no findings about Mr. Womack's specific role. What was the scope of his agreement? And in the relevant conduct guideline, we have to look at what the scope of the defendant's there has to be individual findings about what the scope of his agreement was. Mr. Womack didn't enter the conspiracy until nearly 15 months after it started.
Well, by the time he entered it, was it not clearly foreseeable that he was going to be involved in a conspiracy that was going to be using firearms to help enforce drug trafficking?
That's the question that the court never made any findings on. The two findings that the court made in applying the enhancement were, one, that it was reasonably foreseeable to Mr. Womack that guns would be used because he has a history of selling drugs and using guns, and two, that the fact that he knew Womack and he knew Womack to have used guns in the past was enough. You can't be responsible.
I guess what I'm trying to ask, maybe inartfully, is or would we be making Judge McHugh an offender for lack of a word? Isn't it fairly implicit in what he said that he understood what was going on and Mr. Womack understood what was going on in the course of this? He was saying, look, this is clear. You're a guy with experience. You know how drug trafficking operates. You knew what was going on, and you came into this with your eyes open. That's not fairly inferable from anything Judge McHugh said.
I think that his findings were too narrow in light of the fact that 1B1.3 specifically tells us that we have to look at what the scope of the defendant's agreement was. And there's testimony that Mr. Womack wanted to get Dorsey off the street and away from these guns because it was his whole argument was it's too dangerous and it's too cost prohibitive to be doing this kind of day-to-day sales. I want to get you some weight to get you away from that.
But look, so is your argument at bottom that the facts don't support the enhancement or that we need to remand it for Judge McHugh to make a more robust record?
So the facts as Judge McHugh found them don't support the enhancement because they lack the scope of the jointly undertaking criminal activity. Womack, his role was limited. He came into the conspiracy late. His goal when he came into the conspiracy was to get his nephew off the streets and still absolutely enter into a conspiracy to provide weight and provided that connection. So I think that Judge McHugh did not make sufficient findings, and it should be remanded for the judge to look. It's possible that on remand the judge is going to find the same things, but Collado and 1B1.3 require this specific factual finding as to the defendants. It's not enough to say that guns are always associated with drugs, that they're coextensive. There had to be, and given Mr. Womack's limited role in the conspiracy, I would submit that the court's findings were insufficient. Thank you.
Mr. Eisenberg.
Good afternoon, judges. My name is Martin Eisenberg, and I represent Spencer Payne. Nice to see your judges this afternoon. Judges, I was the trial attorney for Spencer Payne during this entire trial. I was court-appointed as a CJA attorney. During my representation of Mr. Payne, we had an opportunity to sit down with the government after the second superseding indictment was issued, to proffer with the government. During that time of the proffer, which lasted for quite a bit of time, Mr. Payne at that point admitted to various charges in this case.
So he admitted to it, and then he pled guilty to substantive charges, but forced the government to prove the conspiracy, right, Mr. Eisenberg?
That is correct, Judge. But in the opening and in the closing, we indicated to the jury very clearly that Mr. Payne was admitting to the substantive charges. In addition to
is that enough?
Yeah,
for the acceptance.
We're talking about acceptance of responsibility here. Is that what we're going with?
That is what we're talking about, and the denial of the acceptance of responsibility at the time of sentencing, under 3E1.1.
Right. So, who's got the burden to demonstrate acceptance?
The defense.
Okay. Now, having put the government to the proof on part of the case, I read the colloquy, it looked like Judge McHugh said, hey, you made some sensible concessions, that was good, strategic move by you, I'm not faulting your lawyering, far from it, I think it's a good idea, but it doesn't constitute acceptance of responsibility. What is wrong with that reasoning?
Well, that's one of the factors, Judge, but there are other factors, and those factors are is that prior to trial, my client sat down with me and the government and admitted to these charges. In addition to that, we were limited during the trial.
Did he admit to the conspiracy?
No, he did not.
Okay.
But he has the constitutional right, Judge, to have gone to trial on that.
Sure. No question about that.
And that shouldn't be held against him.
Everybody's on the same page about that. The question is, having chosen to stand on his rights, I mean, you can have a grand disagreement about the balance that struck the policies behind the sentencing guidelines and whether it's too big a hammer to let the government, you know, have this acceptance of responsibility benefit that it can give or withhold. But none of that's in front of us right now. The only question is, having chosen to go to trial on and put the government to its proof on something that was not admitted, how can Mr. Payne complain that I accepted responsibility when clearly on the biggest charge of all, he didn't accept responsibility?
I understand that, and that is one of the factors, and there's a totality of circumstances that the court has to follow. And what I'm saying is the totality of the circumstances should include what my client did pretrial and what I was limited to do when we started the trial because of the admissions that Mr. Payne had made prior to trial. And again, these were things that were told to the jury right from the beginning, Judge. And they were also told at the closing, please find my client guilty of these charges. That's an acceptance.
What's the standard of review for this? Is this a finding by the court that there wasn't acceptance of responsibility?
Well, the court has given great deference in this issue, Judge, in the application notes of 3E1.1. The judge is given great deference in making a decision regarding whether to give a defendant the 2-point reduction for acceptance of responsibility. And it does, the application notes do list a certain amount of items that the court should take into consideration, but it's not limited to those.
They start with truthfully admitting the conduct comprising the offenses. He didn't admit to the conduct of conspiracy.
He didn't admit to the conspiracy. That is correct. And he chose to go forward with trial on that. That is correct. But he did admit to the substantive charges. And he did do it at a proffer shortly after the second superseding indictment. And we have the motion that was filed to prevent me from asking various questions because he had made those admissions. And again, he chose to go forward on trial. He has the absolute right to do so. And there are cases which said that if someone goes forward with a trial and then pleads guilty afterwards, they can get acceptance of responsibility. It is a factor that the court needs to take into consideration. It's the totality of circumstances argument.
Okay. Where's the abuse, though? Where is it?
Well, I'm not sure. I'll go back to the argument Ms. McGrain had with Judge Restrepo. Perhaps the court could have been more robust in making a finding on this issue.
All right.
Okay. Thank you, judges.
Ms. Luguzzi, we've got you on video here, and query whether you had any argument you wanted to present.
I'd like to quickly piggyback off of what Mr. Eisenberg was just arguing about in terms of the acceptance of responsibility. With regards to, good afternoon, excuse me, Karina Luguzzi for Mr. Burton. With regards to Mr. Burton's issue number 2, which is the acceptance of responsibility argument that Mr. Eisenberg was just making, in the government's response brief, the 3 main arguments or cases that they used in order to counter Mr. Burton's argument was United States versus Lesner, Felton, and Boone. However, these cases are clearly distinguishable from Mr. Burton's position and possibly from Mr. Payne's position, because in Lesner and Felton, the only argument was for that third acceptance of responsibility point, which is given for timely notification, which is not at issue here. Also in Boone, which was the 2002 case before this circuit, it was Mr. Boone had met with investigators. However, he had never explicitly admitted that the package that he had actually contained drugs. And that also is obviously remarkable in this case because both Burton and Payne, and I believe everyone, did admit ahead of time that they were drug dealers. So that's not in dispute. The dispute was always that they were individual.
Yeah. And having chosen to put the government to its proof on conspiracy, again, can you point to anything that would constitute an abuse of the court's discretion, if that's the standard, or a clearly erroneous finding, if that's the standard, in saying there isn't an acceptance of responsibility here?
I think we can go back to, the argument of the totality of circumstances, and that as has been affirmed by Williams, that indeed the judge did not give sufficient reasoning for his totality of circumstances argument. It wasn't enough just to say, well, they went to trial, and so therefore they don't get it.
We didn't say, they went to trial. He said, I understand why they admitted what they did admit, and it wasn't because they were trying to accept responsibility. It was a strategic move to limit their exposure, and that's fine. You can do that, but that's not the same thing as accepting responsibility. Strategic behavior is not accepting responsibility. I reject your argument in that regard. You put the government to its proof, therefore you lose. That's how I read his reasoning. What's wrong with it?
Because that's just one argument, and that's just one of the totalities, if you will, to take into account.
Okay. Can I ask you a question about your 404B argument?
Yes.
Why is 404B in play here at all? Why isn't the evidence with respect to shootings evidence intrinsic to the charged conspiracy and therefore just, 404B is irrelevant?
Well, specifically with regards to 404B and my client, it is extremely important for Mr. Burton because he was actually not involved in the shootings that were presented.
Yeah, but
so
that's I understand your factual point. I'm trying to get you to deal with this legal question. I could understand if you said, look, the government wanted to present, did present evidence that Mr. Burton was involved in this other conspiracy. He had another conspiracy, and a lot of the methods of operation were the same, so you should believe us when we tell you he was involved in this conspiracy. That's sort of classic 404B. But here, the shootings are presented as proof of a commonality, a mutual intent, as evidence of this conspiracy. Why is it that those are 404B pieces of evidence and not just evidence of this conspiracy subject to 401, 402, and 403, but not 404B?
Well, I believe that in the government's response, they had made the argument we had made much of the probative value. So it's not so much a 404B argument as it is the 403 argument that we had.
Good enough.
That's established.
Great. That helps.
Hopefully.
Yep, that helps. Thanks very much. Anything?
The only other argument that is specific to my client is the in his issue for his he was not allowed to have a mitigating role factor. I believe that the briefs speak for themselves. However, I am happy to go through some of the government's case law that I believe is completely not irrelevant, but completely distinguishable from Mr. Burton. They mentioned Holmes. Holmes was completely different. He had admitted to being a distributor for the conspiracy, so that's different than Mr. Burton's case, and his involvement actually was 1/5 of the conspiracy. He had admitted to 10 out of the 50 kilograms that the conspiracy had been found guilty of. In Samaniego, Defendant's role in transportation was not that of a mere mule, but it was integral to the success of the organization. Again, here, Mr. Burton's small dealings on the side, so to speak, were not integral part of an organization. In Brown, the appellant had, Mr. Brown had rented automobiles and obtained cell phones. Both of these were integral parts of the organization and were used to further the goals of the conspiracy. In Serene, they had basically used Headley as their main argument, and that, you know, he had only argued that he had taken orders from his father, but again, he had done other things as a result of what his father told him to do that were part of the organization.
This is a subject to clear error view, right? This minimal role?
Correct.
Yeah.
Plain error?
Correct.
No, I'm sorry. Thank you. And the question then is, help me with the, where did the court plainly err here? Point me to the factual thing that you can say, oh, look, that just can't stand. The district court made a specific finding that his role might have been less than some of the other conspirators, but that his role could not be considered minimal within the meaning of the guidelines.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I actually have four. The first is that, as was argued during sentencing, he was a lone wolf. He was not involved in the packaging with other co-conspirators or as part of the organization. He only sold narcotics from one location.
The court rejected that, right? The court,
said,
right. So it's, I may be doing a good job of this, but telling me that what the court rejected isn't helping me understand why the court could, as a legal matter, be said to have clearly erred in rejecting your argument. What is it in the record that you can point to that shows, oh my gosh, was he ever off the beam when he said that, that district court judge, when there's documented relationships and dealings that Mr. Burton was having with others charged in the conspiracy, and he was supplying to people to sell, and he was helping people to sell. He was doing a bunch of stuff that the district court looked at and said, not a lone wolf in the conspiracy. What can you point to in the record that shows that's wrong, clearly wrong?
I don't know if it's just one thing that one can point to in the record that says that the judge was clearly wrong. Clearly, our argument is that by rejecting the four main arguments that Mr. Burton presented at sentencing, the court was wrong. But specifically with the fact that simply because you have conversations with other people, you point them in a different direction, does not lessen your entitlement to a mitigating adjustment.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Zosmer, your turn.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please the court? Robert Zosmer on behalf of the government. Good afternoon. So a lot of ground to cover. Unless the court wishes otherwise, I'll go in order with what's been presented today. First, with regard to the expert testimony issue, I'll talk about this group thing, but taking just a step back, I think the law is very settled in this circuit as to what is appropriate expert testimony regarding the conduct of a drug organization, and that is that an expert cannot testify as to the ultimate issue, cannot say, I believe this person had the intent to distribute.
We're all on the same page. Could you start off with the standard of review on this issue?
The standard review on this issue is abuse of discretion. This is a question of the admission of evidence, and it's settled. The question is whether the district court abused its discretion. Should this court find that there was an abuse of discretion, then we would reach the harmless error question as to whether the error was harmless or not. But in finding an error, it's a deferential abuse of discretion standard.
Okay.
And so as I said, what is very clear here under settled law is that the expert is allowed to talk about the characteristics of an organization, and even, of course, the characteristics that are seen in the evidence, and then express an opinion as to whether those characteristics are, quote, consistent with the final issue, whether that be conspiracy or intent or anything else. Agent Updegraff's testimony in this case followed that perfectly. When he talked about a group, he was not talking about this group. He was being asked over and over again, what have you seen in your investigation of groups? And what are the characteristics that show that a group is collectively engaged in illegal activity? And he went through it and he gave the characteristics. And I'll point the court, what really illustrates how well this was done, consistent with this court's guidance, is the very last question that was asked by the prosecutor. It's on page 2047 of the Womack appendix. And the prosecutor was Ashley Lunkenheimer, no longer with our office, and I wish she were, because I would stop by and commend her for how perfectly she followed the pattern here. Her last question was, and so all of these factors, now we've gone through from coded language and firearms and stashes of drugs, overall, do they help inform your opinion about whether individuals are working collectively or separately? And he answered, yes, they have. And that was it. She stopped. And that's exactly how this is done. You tell the jury, these are the characteristics I look at, and then the jury knows, all right, this expert has seen this before, and now I'm going to apply it to the evidence case and decide whether these people were acting collectively.
Did he ever say that the members of the group acting in concert?
He never did. And certainly using the collective term group does not reach the ultimate issue in the case. As Your Honor was suggesting, and I'll adopt it, groups get together all the time. The fact that I might get together with a group of friends for lunch doesn't mean that we have reached an unlawful agreement to violate federal law and are acting with intent. It doesn't mean that at all. And he never said anything remotely close to that suggestion. Certainly never said that he knew the thinking of these defendants on trial, which is what would violate Watson. So there was no abuse of discretion here. The judge carefully monitored this, permitted what is appropriate under this court's precedent, and there was no error. With regard to the next question involving the shootings, the question was asked as to, there was no objection. This is plain error review. And this court asked this afternoon, when was the objection first made? Well, interestingly, whatever objection was made, it really wasn't even an objection, wasn't made until the defense itself had raised this. The first witness in the trial was Agent Updegraff. And on direct examination, he didn't say anything about shootings. It was on cross-examination, I believe it was Burton's attorney, who got into it and started asking Dorsey about shootings in the neighborhood. At the end of the day, the trial judge asked, all right, well, anybody have any problem with any of this? And the question was raised by Burton's attorney. And the answer given by the prosecutor, we're introducing shootings because we're interested in the reaction. We're interested.
Before we get to that, I want to step back because I want you to respond to something on page 21 of, I believe this is Mr. Whitehead's brief. A lot of briefs. He quotes from Appendix 1781 the following, quote, the coded language over the phone call, it just gives an indication that they are working in concert to try to defeat detection by law enforcement. And then on the next page, I think we've seen a lot during the course of the trial of individuals standing and watching to, they are working in concert, watching for one another as the other goes into the alleyways to make a deal.
Right.
Should that language make us go, whoa, stop?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because you look at the full context of this testimony, it starts about four or five pages before that when they start talking about the characteristics of groups, and it's very clear that he is talking about what he has observed in other investigations. And when he mentions that it is seen in this case, he's just tying it to the evidence in this case. He is still not expressing an opinion regarding the ultimate issue in the case, which is whether these defendants intentionally agreed with each other to commit a crime.
Here's the heartburn. He says, we've seen it during the course of the trial, meaning that trial, individuals standing watching, they are working in concert. Isn't that a statement that you've seen these people and the evidence is they were working in concert?
Again, I think read in full context, he is not and really cannot talk about the intent of these individuals. Who he doesn't.
No, he's not supposed to. No. That's what the argument is about.
Oh, when I say cannot, I mean that he doesn't know these people. He didn't talk to these people. He wasn't there dealing with them. A jury is not going to accept, and this court has said the same thing in other cases. The jury's not going to.
He's the case agent. That's another. That's speaking of beefs. That's another beef we've got from the other side here. They're saying they put the fact guy up, and he tells about the investigation, and then he says, and I'm an expert on Dalla. Now I'm going to tell you what it means. What I just told you about, I'm going to tell you what it means.
But as this court has said in other cases, a jury is not going to assume that even the case agent, who does not personally know these people, can answer the question as to what's going on in their minds. He can talk about what he saw, and he can talk about whether it's consistent right. with what he has seen elsewhere.
What's the context? When you say it's got to be read in context, help me with the context that makes it okay for the case agent to say, in this trial, these individuals we've seen, .. working in concert.
The context is that the full testimony is clearly about what he is, the characteristics he's observed in other investigations. And then the last thing I'll say on that, Your Honor, well, it won't be the last thing if you have more questions, but what I'll say about it also, this is where we might get to harmless error. If the court is really concerned about that one line in his full testimony, which was clearly focused on what he has seen elsewhere, in the middle of a 19-day trial in which there's an avalanche of evidence regarding the efforts of these defendants, then I would say yes, if there was an error for that one line, that it was certainly harmless. Now, if I may, just to wrap up regarding the shootings, the relevance of the shootings was that they armed themselves in order to respond, and they collectively armed themselves in order to protect the neighborhood because shootings were bad for business. The district court explicitly told the jury that this was a separate beef. It has nothing to do with drug dealing. It's not why you're hearing this. Nobody's holding these people responsible for shooting. It's for arming those. And there was no plain error here in admitting that. Your Honor asked a question of my friend, Ms. Liguzzi, about 404B. I believe in her brief, in Burton's brief on page 21, it's avowed that this is not a 404B issue. So we're all on the same page. This is not 404B. This is relevant evidence to prove the conspiracy and to prove the collective actions of these people. Turning next to the question regarding the firearm enhancement, I want to save the best for last involving the administering issue and the controlled substance offense. The firearm enhancement, the argument that was presented by Ms. McGrain today, I think is different from what's in her brief. Her reply brief on page 5 says the argument is that the use of firearms was not reasonably foreseeable to Mr. Womack. And she stood up and said, yes, it was, because there were conversations, and we pointed out in our brief, where he's right there, where they're talking about arming themselves. Her argument today is it's outside the scope of his agreement. That isn't the argument that was presented in the briefs. It's not accurate. Womack was involved in setting up the supply. He got a cut from many of the transactions for at least a year. He was Dorsey's close cousin. They talked about everything. Certainly, it was within the scope of his agreement in furthering this drug trafficking organization that people were arming themselves in order to protect the organization. The acceptance of responsibility and minimal role, I don't have much to say about. These are reviewed for clear error. The district court is clearly acting appropriately when someone doesn't plead guilty and goes to trial on the issue. They did plead guilty to lesser distribution offenses, which would have resulted in sentences that are a fraction of what they were responsible for under the conspiracy charges. And the minimal role as well, there was no clear error on that. I'd like to focus on the administering issue, this question of whether Pennsylvania drug trafficking is broader than a controlled substance offense under the career offender guideline. I do believe that this argument, with all respect, is rather frivolous. But it's also very significant because it's being raised in case after case, week after week, in our district courts in this circuit. And I don't often do this. In fact, I do this very rarely, but I'd like to respectfully ask that the court consider a precedential opinion on this issue because district courts are being presented with it every single week in the courthouse and in the other courthouses in the circuit. It is the flavor of the month.
So what's your pitch? Why is Mr. Goldberger's position...
So the pitch is, and I also just want to say briefly, there are two flavors of the month. The other flavor is saying that the Pennsylvania drug trafficking statute not only reaches administering, which makes it too broad, but also reaches attempted transfer that makes it too broad. That was not briefed by the defense here until Mr. Goldberger's reply brief. It has been extensively briefed in other cases in this circuit, and there was an oral argument last month in the Dorian Dawson case before Judges Greenaway, Sirica, and Rendell. So I think they're on top of that, and that's something on which we would very much appreciate a resolution as well, because that's the other current assault. Getting to the administering question, I'll talk about the attempt if the court's interested, but what's before this court is administering, and it's a pretty simple issue. The controlled substance offense definition in the guideline includes delivery. It's an offense that involves manufacture, delivery, possession with intent. But delivery is the key word for our purposes. The Pennsylvania statute, this is section 780.113.830. I'm corrected. The guideline refers to distribution or dispensing. The Pennsylvania statute refers to delivery. And then it defines delivery as the actual constructive or attempted transfer from one person to another of a controlled substance, other drug, device, or cosmetic, where there's not an agency relationship. That is distribution. And no court has ever held otherwise. These statutes are a match. What's very interesting is that definition of delivery as part of distribution, which is in the state statute as we lay out in our brief, is identical word for word to the federal definition of distribution and delivery. And so what it means is that if this argument were to prevail today, that somehow the main Pennsylvania drug trafficking statute is not a controlled substance offense for this reason, then neither is federal drug distribution under Section 841, which would be quite astounding that the Sentencing Commission passed a career offender guideline at the direction of Congress and left out the federal drug trafficking statute. So the suggestion that's being made here is that somehow the Pennsylvania statute is overbroad because it also reaches, quote, administering. And administering has another definition under state law. Administering is the direct application of a controlled substance to the body of a patient or a research subject. That's not referenced at all in the Pennsylvania drug traffic statute that we're dealing with, section 780.113.830. It mentions delivery. It doesn't mention administering. And in fact, in 780.113, which is the broad Pennsylvania drug statute that has numerous subsections, there are about three of the 36 or so subsections that do mention administering. That's why the definition is there. So
it's used in other statutes, right? The administering
language. It is.
Do they shed any light on the purpose of that word?
Well, they do, because those three set there, we're still in 780.113A, and it's 13, 14, and 35 that are the ones that refer to administering, not 30, which is the main drug trafficking statute. 13, 14, 35 are all about practitioners. They're all about carve-outs and rules regarding what licensed practitioners can do, because that's what administering is about. It's about
safe harbors right. For doctors and nurses.
Exactly, and it's because they are administering drugs to the body of a patient or a research subject. So that this all fits. I really don't know where this argument came from, that somehow the Pennsylvania drug statute, subsection 30, which is the main one that criminals are charged with, where this argument came from, that this reaches administering to the body of a research subject or patient. On the plain language of the statute, it's not there. And then so the final place that this takes us is what's called the reasonable probability standard that the Supreme Court has set. So we're stuck with this categorical approach, and the Supreme Court says that if you want to come up with some hypothetical of what is categorically outside a statute, there has to be a reasonable probability that the state would apply the statute in the creative way that you're suggesting.
Has our circuit shut that door?
No, nor could it, because it's a direction from the Supreme Court. This court has has shut the door a little bit. What this court has said in cases like Salvorin and some others is that where the language of the statute is explicit, where it's clear that there's a categorical overbreath,
then there's no basis for going to reasonable probability.
Right, and you don't go to, and reasonable probability takes you on an expedition looking for other cases, and you don't have to do that if the statutory language is clear. As I've made very clear here, I hope, the statutory language here does not support at all the suggestion that subsection 30 reaches administering. There's nothing on the face of the statute that makes it overbroad with respect to delivery.
That's true. We would never, we wouldn't have any occasion to think about reasonable probability, right? If, unless I misunderstood what you just said, you've made the argument that there's no rational way to read the statute the way Mr. Goldberger is asserting, that administering has a specific meaning. It's explicated in subsections A13, A14, and A35 of 780-113. And so you don't have to be confused, and nobody else should be confused. And if that's true, then we would never be asking the question under our precedent about reasonable probability, would we?
Well, I think we would. To be fair to defendants, I think there may be situations in which you would. So if you had a statute where you're looking at the plain language all day long and it doesn't look like there's overbreath, but there is a state decision out there, say of the state Supreme Court, in which the court did extend the statute to a situation that it doesn't appear on the face of the statute that it would, that's where a defendant could satisfy the reasonable probability argument.
Is that the situation here?
No, because there is no case. So what Mr. Goldberger, my good friend, says in his reply brief is that, well, maybe it's happened somewhere. Maybe somebody has been prosecuted under A30 for delivering a drug to the body of a research subject.
I'm just trying to figure out why you want us to get into reasonable probability.
I'm not saying I do, Your Honor. I'm saying it's the last step. It's the last nail that I think I'm required to talk about. But I think that clearly on the face of these statutes themselves, they're very clear. It's very clear that administering is talking about the work of a practitioner that's addressed in other statutes. And that if somebody who is not a practitioner, who's not acting under any license, delivers drugs to anybody, they're not just guilty of a state crime, but they also fall squarely within the controlled substance offense definition.
If I could just be clear, so in your hypothetical precedential opinion, you don't think we need to get to reasonable probability?
I don't. I think this is a very clear answer. But I do think you need to cover the field. And when, you know, my very respected colleague says in his reply brief that, well, maybe there'll be a case one day like this, I have to say that that doesn't cut it under the guidance of the Supreme Court, which we're required to follow. So I think I've covered the issues, unless the court has further questions. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and have rebuttal.
Mr. Goldberger, do you want me to go first because it'll be quick, or do you want him to go first?
Let's just go in the right, in the order we took him in to start with.
Sounds good.
First, on the harmless error question with respect to the 704B argument, the government did not argue harmless error at any point in their brief. That point is waived for the appellee.
Can they waive that?
Yes.
I mean, don't we have an obligation, if we thought there was error, then to say, okay, what's the impact of that error, and apply the standard that applies? And you pointed out accurately, it's harmless error.
No. Can you waive the standard of review?
I think I'm going to agree with my friend, Mr. Zosmer, on here that harmless error is not the standard of review. The standard of review is abuse of discretion. The government can try to win an appeal notwithstanding having reversible error if it can show harmless error. It has a duty to go forward in the appellee's brief. You could say it.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't, it's not the way I frame it, but I'm not going to argue with you about that. Okay. I mean, it's framed that way sometimes.
All right.
I think the weakest possible argument on the expert is the one that Mr. Zosmer liked so much, which was the last question that was asked was not improper. But it doesn't tell us that there weren't plenty of improper questions asked and improper answers given, which I highlighted in my brief, and Your Honor read a couple of them. The case agent can be used as an expert if the case agent is carefully asked a hypothetical question, which can be based on the real facts of the case, but not as here where the case agent used as an expert is asked to volunteer from his own knowledge of the investigation of the case what the facts are, and then express the opinion, which goes to mental state, which is the intent to agree, which is implicit in the way the government used the word group in this case.
Okay.
So could I take another second on the administration question?
You know what? We'll give you another minute there. We've had a lot of argument,
but
that's an important point, so go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We've used time. A non-practitioner can be guilty under A3 of administering if the person to whom the drug is administered in Pennsylvania law, if the person to whom the drug is administered is a patient. And I think you can readily imagine such cases readily if you needed to imagine them. This happens in mercy killing situations, in hospices, in families, where the drug is administered to a helpless person. And if that drug is it's a sad story, but it's not a fanciful or outlandish story by any means. We read about such stories all the time. They may not often be prosecuted. When they're prosecuted, they are dealt with appropriately by ARD in Pennsylvania or probation cases, but they're real cases.
They're not dealt with, are they, as drug trafficking cases?
They could be prosecuted under this statute. It's plain language. It's just not true. To have this argument called frivolous is just wrong. It's the plain language of this statute plainly covers it.
So I've got two sides telling me how plain this is in opposite directions.
Yeah.
But I got you. We have your argument. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, thank you very much. And you know the Cabeda case better than either of us about the realistic probability. That's the law of this circuit.
Yeah, we're with you. We understand.
Thank you.
Mr. McGrain.
I just wanted to quickly address Mr. Zosmer's argument that I did not raise this issue about reasonable foreseeability. The court's reasonable foreseeability test said that it will always be reasonably foreseeable if you have familiarity with guns and drugs. So, yes, but on page 28 of my brief, I made the point whether an individual defendant can reasonably foresee acts of his co-conspirators depends upon the degree of the defendant's involvement in the conspiracy, citing Collado. The defendant can have a substantial role in a conspiracy, but if it's not one that is individually related to the guns, then it cannot be reasonably foreseeable. You have to look both at, is it something the defendant knew or should have known, and also, was it within the scope of his agreement? So I raised that on page 28, on page 32, and finally on page 9 of my reply brief, where I say the court and the government rely upon generalizations about the ubiquitous nature of guns and drugs. That's an insufficient basis to support the enhancement. Thank you.
All right, we thank counsel for a thoroughly briefed and well-argued case. We've got it under advisement, and we'll recess court.